Quit. Yes. Is the emphasis in this passage on rights or on responsibility?
Rights. Rights. Chapter 4 and verse 4. The wife does not rule over her own body.
Yes, she does not. Who rules over whose body?
But the husband does.
Okay. My wife rules over whose body? Mine. And whose do I rule over? Hers. The emphasis, though, is not on the right to have my need met, but the emphasis is on my responsibility to meet my partner's needs. The only right I have is to meet the need of my mate. That is the focus of this paragraph.
To meet that need, you have to do more than just this particular sexual fulfillment we're talking about. You have to take care of that body. You have to love it. You have to love this body that you're responsible for.
Yes, you do. Yes, you do. And most problems that we experience in the bedroom don't have their source in the bedroom. They have their source in the living room, the kitchen. And then we reap the problem in the bedroom. It's a good point. Any other observations from this passage?
Not refuse the right to each other. The only exception to this rule would be the agreement of both husband and wife to refrain from the rights of marriage for a limited time so that they could give themselves more completely in prayer.
Mm-hmm.
So, I would think the only excuse, if you want to call it that, would be to have the direct line with God through prayer for both of them.
Yeah, when's the last time you and your mate decided that you'd refrain from sexual intercourse for the practice of your spiritual intercourse with God? I haven't had that problem. Now that may be somewhat of a sad commentary, I don't know. But the only time you would stop is by mutual agreement for spiritual purpose. Now, I think the idea here is that sex is not to be used as the club, a weapon in your relationship with your mate. And, I think there's a possibility, from what I've heard, rumors, that women can use sex as a weapon, as a club, to get their way with their husband. And I'd say that, from scriptures, is a foul ball. Stop depriving one another. Now, I don't think the tone of this thing is that so much that I go to my wife and say, hey, I got a need, you meet it. I think the idea is for each of us to be sensitive to the need that our mate has and reach out and meet it. And as we know the other, you know when the other is in need. The emphasis is not so much on how you feel at the time, but meeting the other's need. Why is it important in this context here, verse 2, that we meet one another's needs? Because of immoralities. Failing to meet our mate's needs sets our mate up for temptation. Unnecessarily so. I would suggest that perhaps prostitution would go off the market if this little piece of advice in 1 Corinthians 7 were met. At least married men wouldn't be participating. They'd be too busy at home. Okay. I think here we have a very realistic view of the sexual relationship. I don't think this is a degrading paragraph that Paul writes at all. It's just a realistic view of the problem. Now, the third purpose of sexual relationship in marriage is to promote mutual love. This is the pleasure principle. The purpose is to provide pleasure for both mates. You know, there's a bunch of scripture that deals with this issue, and this is where we get into the exciting part of things. And before we do and get too nervous about it, why don't we take a break? Okay, let's examine together this third principle, or third, not principle. We are dealing with the second principle from Genesis 1 and 2. And we are on the third purpose of the sexual relationship, to promote mutual love or to provide pleasure, the pleasure principle. Now, I'd like to quickly look at half a dozen passages of Scripture that would indicate that God gave us the sexual relationship to enjoy. If this principle is true, then it answers a number of other questions. There are many implications of this. All right? I'd like someone to look up Genesis 18, verses 9 through 15. Who would like to do that for us? All right, good. You look there. Genesis 26, verse 8. Who would like to read that for us here in a minute? Okay. Deuteronomy 24, verse 5. Who would like to look that up? Okay. Proverbs 5, verse 15, 18, and 19. 15, 18, and 19. Okay, Proverbs 5. And then we're all going to look in the Song of Solomon together. And the references that we'll look at in the Song of Solomon, if you want to jot these down, Song of Solomon, chapter 4, verse 1, through chapter 5, verse 1, chapter 7, verse 1, through verse 10. Song of Solomon, 4:1 through 5:1. Song of Solomon, 7:1 through 7:10. All right, let's start with Genesis 18, 9 through 15. And let's concentrate on verse 12. All right, who has that? Okay.
Then they said to him, "Where is Sarah, your wife?" And he said, "Behold, and he said, I will surely return to you at this time next year. And behold, Sarah your wife shall have a son." And Sarah was listening at the tent door, which was behind her. Now Abraham and Sarah were old, advanced in age. It had ceased to be with Sarah after the manner of women. And Sarah laughed to herself, saying, "After I have become old, shall I have pleasure, my Lord being old also?" And the Lord said to Abraham, "Why did Sarah laugh, saying, 'Shall I indeed bear a child when I am so old?' If anything too difficult for the Lord, at the appointed time I will return to you at this time next year, and Sarah will have a son." Sarah denied it, however, saying, "I did not laugh, for she was afraid." And he said, "No, but you did laugh."
How did Sarah refer to the sexual act? Shall I have pleasure? Isn't that interesting? All right? Yes.
Is she referring to having a baby there?
Is she referring to... Where is her focus? Is it on clinically becoming impregnated?
I think it's having the baby, you know. Actually having the child.
Yes.
More than the Amplified says, shall I have pleasure and delight?
Yes. The use of the word pleasure and delight signifies what? Huh? Yeah, she's thinking about herself. And what are these words descriptive of? Emotion. Are they not? She's talking here, shall I have pleasure with my Lord? Shall I enjoy this sensation of the sexual relationship with my Lord? What's it going to end in? Having a baby. But the focus here in this statement is not on having the child, but on knowing her husband in this relationship. After I have become old, shall I have pleasure, my Lord being old also? You think that she's saying, shall I have pleasure? Do you think that refers to I have pleasure having a child, the pleasure that comes from having a child?
Look at the next verse.
And the Lord said to Abraham, why did Sarah laugh? Shall I indeed bear a child when I am so old? I would suggest to you that Sarah's focus of attention is not on that child, but is on the process of having that child when she says this to herself in verse 12.
Does this say then that they had given that up since they were old?
I would suggest that that is true. How old are they at this time? Yeah, they're in their late 90s. Okay? Genesis 26:8.
And it came about when he had been there a long time that Abimelech, king of the Philistines, looked out through a window and saw, and behold, Isaac was caressing his wife Rebekah.
Okay, what's old Isaac doing to his wife here? Oh, come on, what's he doing? Loving her?
The Revised Standard Version says fondling.
Fondling? The old cad. Okay, Genesis 26:8.
Just that one verse.
Easy, man, easy. Okay, the word here for caress can be translated two ways. It can be translated three ways: caressing, fondling, sporting. Isaac was participating in the greatest of all indoor sports. The only problem with this, that he was doing it in an inappropriate place, apparently, because it was observable by an outsider, which should never be the case. He was fondling his wife.
Laughing.
Laughing.
In the earlier version, when they were talking about pleasure, it was always talking about having kids. So there was nothing about pleasure in that in her translation. So I just wonder. warn all of you that this is not the version you get for this.
Okay, fine.
Well, I go to another extreme, though. The Living Bible paraphrase says Isaac was petting with his wife.
No. I think you get the idea of what that Hebrew word means. He was not engaged in the clinical process of having children. He was enjoying himself, and so was Rebecca. Okay, Deuteronomy 24:5.
When a man takes a new wife, he shall not go out with the army, nor be charged with any duty. He shall be freed home 1 year, and shall give happiness to his wife whom he has taken.
Okay, what can we learn from this verse? Deuteronomy 24:5.
Get married before you go in the service.
Tremendous. Is there anything else we can learn from this statement? Take care of the home front. You bet. Let's get a little more specific. Wait, what was that? Be happy with his wife.
Get well acquainted.
A 1 year honeymoon. And what is the purpose of this 1 year honeymoon?
To give happiness.
Oh. Yes, and shall cheer his wife whom he has taken, or shall give happiness to his wife whom he has taken. Boy, he's supposed to, you know, not go in the army for a year, just to build that relationship and enjoy one another physically. Why? We don't have that provision today, do we? But I think there are some principles involved in here that we could sure pay attention to. And one of them might be to newly marrieds that don't spread yourself thin in that initial year of your marriage. Boy, get to know one another and concentrate on your relationship together and enjoy one another. Okay, Proverbs chapter 5. We all better turn there. Proverbs 5:15, 18, and 19.
Drink water from your own cistern, flowing water from your own well. Let your fountain be blessed and rejoice in the wife of your youth, a lovely hind and graceful doe. Let her affection fill you at all times with delight. Be infatuated always with her love.
Okay, when you know it. Does someone else have this in a different translation? Yes. You have a Living? Let's see what the Living does with it. Just 18 and 19 right now.
Let your manhood be a blessing. Rejoice in the wife of your youth. Let her charms and tender embrace satisfy you. Let her love alone fill you with delight.
Mm. We have just done such things with the scriptures here. Just, isn't it beautiful? Let me read it from the New American Standard. It'll arrive at the same thing that you're talking about here, but it is a little more pointed and a little more helpful. Let your fountain be blessed and rejoice in the wife of your youth. As a loving hind and a graceful doe, let her breasts satisfy you at all times. Be exhilarated always with her love. It is, isn't it? You see, the statement is made with no shame. And apparently, breasts of a woman have multiple purposes. Not only are they for the care of new children, but also to bring pleasure to her husband. This, I think, will produce all these nice things that these other translations had to say about it. Yes, isn't that nice? Yes, Solomon is teaching his son here. And if you'll take time sometime to look at the context of this, you'll notice again that this is set in the context of immorality. Solomon is warning his son to stay away from the path of the harlot. You know where she hangs out? You don't go down that street. You go around it. And you don't spend yourself on a woman like that. You spend yourself on your wife, your mate. The Song of Solomon is a book written in four parts. I had to do this as a project this summer for a course I took at Dallas Seminary. It was kind of a fun thing to do. And I called this the Song of Solomon. It's the royal thing, or the song of love. Part one of the book has to do with the courtship of the king and his bride. Chapter 1, verse 1 to chapter 3, verse 11. 1:1 to 3:11. Courtship. Chapter 4, verse 1 to chapter 5, verse 1 deals with the wedding night, the consummation of their love relationship. The end of courtship, the beginning of married life. Chapter 5, verse 2 through chapter 7, verse 10 gives us a picture of their first lover's quarrel and how they made up. And then chapter 7, verse 11 through chapter 8, verses through 8:14 deal with considerations or reflections of early childhood, reflections on what love is, their meeting, and that kind of thing. Now, as you go through the Song of Solomon, with this overview in mind, many of the particulars will make sense. In these early chapters, you have statements made by the king, made by his bride-to-be. And they deal with the character of the king. They deal with the character of the bride, their bride's feeling of insecurity and inadequacy, how the king handles that difficulty, her admiration for the king, their time together out courting under the trees, and their desire to protect that relationship, and a bad dream that the bride-to-be has in anticipation of things to come. This section is closed out with a wedding processional. And then we have a glimpse of their wedding night together. It is phenomenal. And we're going to go through that in just a minute. And I summarized it here that he considers the bride beautiful. He is raptured by her. She is anxious. And their love is perfected. Then in the conflict stage, you find the king coming home late at night and his wife is in bed. She gives him the cold shoulder. 1 Corinthians 7 hadn't been written yet. And so the king leaves. And she has a little pang of conscience and goes to the door and finds that he's gone. So she gets dressed and takes off to try to find him. And of course there's some dialogue and chorus entered here, and The ladies in this chorus just ask her a couple of pertinent questions about the king, and then she reflects on his beauty, both physical and his character. And she goes to one of their favorite spots, the garden, and there she finds him. And they have a meeting. He forgives her. And then they are brought together again in another lovemaking session that is described in much more sensual terms than the one on their wedding night. And then it's off to the country together to have fun and to make love together. Not one mention is made of bearing children. Procreation is not the issue of Song of Solomon. Mutual pleasure, mutual enjoyment is the issue. Our sexuality has been given to us by God to enjoy. And as we make love together, we should be able to visualize the presence of God right there in the bedroom with us, seeing His blessing on everything that we do together. It is not only a physical experience, it is a spiritual experience. Nothing to be ashamed of. It is God-given. And God gave us our mate to enjoy physically. I think that is brought out in the Song of Solomon. Turn to chapter 4. Let's spend a minute here. The end of verse 11 in chapter 3, the courtship between Solomon and his bride has come to an end. We have their wedding processional address there, and then their wedding night begins in chapter 4, verse 1. How beautiful you are, my darling, how beautiful you are. Your eyes are like doves behind your veil. Your hair is like a flock of goats. You got to be kidding. Glickman, in his book on the Song of Solomon, was on an airplane, and he was with a guy who wanted to test these metaphors. And so as the stewardess came by, he looked at her and says, "Hey, your eyes are like doves." And she about had a heart attack. She thought that was kind of an insult. But you know what we have here is just metaphor after metaphor after metaphor. And the emphasis of these metaphors is on emotional associations. What we're doing is interpreting poetry. And poetry is very difficult to interpret. You can't work with this like you would the book of Romans. It's very different. It is extremely emotional. Now, when he says, "Your eyes are like doves behind your veil," to what do you think he may be referring? Obviously, he's complimenting her. Do you agree? On his wedding night, he better be. Okay, what associations can you make with dove?
Dove's very soft,
soft,
pure.
Soft,
gentle.
Pure, gentle,
love.
Loving, peaceful. Does that make sense? Would that be a characteristic? It'd say a lot about her character, wouldn't it? All right. Your hair is like a flock of goats.
She has more hair than other girls.
I can tell you really got the mood of this thing. Well, it's like a flock of goats that have descended from Mount Gilead. Yes. Yes, moving down the slopes. is like a flock of I can tell you really got the mood of this thing. Well, it's like a flock of goats that have descended from Mount Gilead. Yes. Yes, moving down the slopes. Yeah, the flock should move down in the evening. So it would be dusk, and it would be kind of dark, and it would be a gentle moving
wave.
Yes. So I suggest probably she has black hair that is soft and wavy. All right, guys, we're going to have to come up with some other type metaphors today because I don't think these would communicate too well in our society.
Why did he use these particular metaphors?
Why? Well, I think that because they are common associations for an agricultural society. Or an agrarian.
Wasn't he a shepherd at one time? Did he?
You bet he was.
So he used what he was associated with.
Yeah.
Signs of wealth in the Middle East.
Yes. And what was his bride to be? Where did she come from? The city or the country?
Country.
She came from the country as well.
And this is something she was associated
with. Oh, yeah. They would both be quite familiar with these sites. All right. Your teeth are like a flock of newly shown. Ewes, huh? Which have come up from their washing, all of which bear twins, and not one of them has lost her young. Oh, my goodness gracious. I think they're all there, huh? You've got it.
That's.
Yeah, it could be. Okay, you got the idea. Do you have the idea of the process? Yes. Oh, yeah. Well, where was his attention fixed? Oh. Wow, I'll say. And then let's get down here. Verse 5, your two breasts are like two fawns, twins of a gazelle, which feed among the lilies. I'll let your mind work on this one a little bit.
I got the picture.
Stan, I don't doubt that a bit. All right. Picture two fawns as described here. What would your desire be toward those fawns? To pet them. Yes. Yeah, I think the natural desire is to want to get out and touch those fawns. Why? Because they're soft. They are very pleasurable to pet and to hold. And I think this is what he is expressing through this metaphor. What? All right. See, then in verse 8, he says, come with me from Lebanon, my bride. And what he's doing here is calling for her undivided attention to leave her fears behind and focus her attention on him. Verse 9, you have made my heart beat faster, my sister, my bride. Sister in here is an affectionate term used to as we would use the word wife, dear, or honey. You have made my heart beat faster with a single glance of your eyes, with a single strand of your necklace. How beautiful is your love, my sister, my bride. How much better is your love than wine and the fragrance of your oils, than all kinds of spices. Your lips, my bride, drip with honey. Honey and milk are under your tongue. How does he know that? I think he's been there. I would have to conclude that French kissing did not originate in France. A garden locked is my sister, my bride. What is this referring to?
Her purity.
Her purity, her virginity. A rock garden locked, a spring sealed up. And then he describes the garden. You are a garden spring, a well of fresh water and streams flowing from Lebanon. And then she responds to this description. Awake, O north wind, and come, wind of the south. Make my garden breathe out fragrance. Let its spices be wafted abroad. May my beloved come into his garden and eat its choice fruits. And what is this? An invitation to make love. Does he accept? Let's go to the next chapter. I have come into my garden. Consummation of their relationship together. Now, we don't have time to continue on through the Song of Solomon. I've kind of run a little bit behind. But if you look at chapter 7 and compare that with what we've just gone through, you'll discover a tremendous development in their relationship together, both of them being more bold and more sensuous in their description and in their conversation with the other. Their physical relationship has matured. Will you buy the fact that there are three principles or three purposes for sex in the Scripture? Will you buy it? Okay, good. What I would like to do now is to spend 30 minutes listening to a portion of this tape by Dr. Ed Wheat as he describes the physical act of love making. He will cover some very, very important concepts to make the pleasure principle more effective in that relationship. And then when he finishes, we'll take a short break, and then we'll have a kind of question and answer session together.
At this point in his message, Mr. Van Amburg played a cassette entitled Sex Problems and Technique in Marriage. If you wish, you may order this tape from Bible Believers Cassettes, 130 North Spring, Springdale, Arkansas, zip code 72764.
That serves several purposes. That gets me off the hook from having to address those issues. Secondly, it allows you to hear the description from a Christian, highly competent medical doctor. And thirdly, it might increase your interest in the tapes to hear the other three sides. As we have listened to the tape, Do any conclusions come to your mind in regard to the area of lovemaking? It is nifty. And I think that leads us to a conclusion, doesn't it? I think the conclusion that comes to my mind in this area is that it should be nifty for every married couple. Now, does the niftiness of it come naturally? Does it come naturally any more than a good marriage relationship comes naturally? No, it doesn't. If you want a good marriage relationship, you work at it. And if you want a good sex life together, you're going to have to work at it. You're going to have to give it some attention with the focus on meeting the need of the other. Any other conclusions that come to your mind from listening to what Dr. Wheat had to say? Great, yes.
Do you feel like that he would agree with your statement that problems are primarily between the ears?
Yes. Yes, he would. And would you like me to, I could expand that a little bit if you'd like.
It just sounded to me maybe more on the surface that he was taking more of a physical approach to remedy problems rather than maybe addressing the fact that it may be that the husband is inadequately ministered spiritually to his wife that would cause her physical problems.
Mm-hmm. I think that's all part of it. It's a complex situation, I agree, because in the sexual relationship, you reap what you sow in so many other areas of your life together. That's kind of like the showcase of the whole relationship. Now, take the area of frigidity, a woman not able to, who has never experienced orgasm, for example. That might be caused just by ignorance, lack of proper education before marriage. That's a possibility. Oftentimes, it has, you know, many other causes that are right up here, having to do with attitudes. You know, what produced those attitudes? Well, any number of things could produce the attitudes. Those attitudes could be produced by a poor relationship with her father. She could enter marriage with a subconscious hatred for men. That's between the ears. It has to do with an attitude. In her marriage relationship with her husband, she may discover after being married to him for several years that she does not respect him. Their relationship, instead of following a biblical pattern, may end up with him taking the role of a child and she taking the role of a mother. And in that configuration, you can see what the cost would be in the sexual relationship. You have the psychology of a mother and a son going to bed together. That doesn't produce a whole lot. But I think with a determination to solve the problem, it's not only a physical solving of the problem, as Dr. Wheat described, but also understanding the relationship that the couple has together and each assuming the role that God has given the other 100% of the way. And this is important that it's done. Because if it's not, the consequences of it are very, very serious. If the sexual relationship between the husband and wife is not what it should be, and each backs off from the other, and let's just say the wife turns to her children as a primary source of affection and attention, say a son, and he becomes the primary center of her affection and attention, the odds are that that relationship will produce a homosexual son. That has been found to be one of the consistent elements in homosexuality. Improper affection between a parent and a child without proper affection and relationship between husband and wife. Homosexuality usually does not have a mysterious cause. It's a very simple cause. So to ignore this area and to accept second to tenth best in it is not good. It's not healthy. Now, the problem in men, as Dr. Wheat talked about, premature ejaculation. What would cause this? Well, one of the causes is, I don't know how to say this, great amount of masturbation before marriage, promiscuity before marriage, involvement with prostitutes where speed is the primary attitude. And then when you get married, you don't have the control that you should have if you didn't fool with sin. See, another problem in marriage, another problem that contributes to this whole thing is when a couple is involved in heavy petting before marriage. They don't need to have intercourse before marriage, but just be involved in heavy petting. Each of us kind of draws a line in our mind of what is acceptable and what's not. And every time in a petting session you cross over that line that you have established in your mind, you have a brick put in a wall by guilt. Then when you're married, you would assume that the wall would come down automatically. But the discovery has been made that once you're married, that wall of guilt remains and is greatly inhibitive to love making in marriage. And to me, this is a classic illustration of God's love for us, in that when He says don't, He is not saying that to us to deny us pleasure, but He's telling us don't, to preserve pleasure for us. He knows how we're made. So He understands this a whole lot better than we do. So sin really takes a toll. And it's in the area of confessing it, realizing your forgiveness of it, and starting over together, that the problems are solved. That's what I mean, that most problems are between your ears. Once the attitudes are cleared up, then physical headway can be made to enjoying the sexual relationship. I think it's neat that these problems can be solved so quickly. And they really can. All it takes is a little determination. Okay? Any other comments that anyone would like to make before we conclude?
Interesting to me is that how the problems we tend to regard our own problems as our own situation. Like a man has a problem, and that's his problem. And the wife is having a difficulty responding. And then in the natural sense, we think that it's her problem. And the thing that comes to me about these kids is how the problems of both of them. And that you don't have unilateral problems of sex and marriage.
Isn't that tremendous? Boy, that's great. Yeah, we're in it together. Cynthia?
Just a thought of how important verbal communication is in this area.
Yes, that is one of the conclusions that I came to in thinking through these things, is that it is absolutely essential that you and your mate be in open communication about every aspect of lovemaking, about every aspect of your bodies. And if you're not in the habit of sharing in other circumstances, I would wager you that it is possible for couples to be involved in lovemaking and have never said anything about it to the other. And I would suggest to you, if that's the case, that's not very good. You need to say something about it. Communicate. Any other comments? Okay, yes. Oh, yes. Almost in every case, it can be overcome following the procedure that Dr. Wheat outlined. And he says, as he continues this thing, when it is not easily overcome, then a family physician in whom you have confidence can be of, you know, further assistance in giving help. From all that I know about the situation, I would say that for a woman to accept no orgasm or infrequent orgasm is not accepting what she could have. I think with a little work on the part of the husband and the wife, this problem can be solved. I think one of the things that I think prohibits or prevents orgasm is fear of failure. I mean, you're in bed together, and boy, the heat's on to perform. And when you're under that pressure, chances are you're not going to perform. That is the underlying principle to the technique that Dr. Wheat outlined. It is being in bed together, you know, having the husband fondle his wife with no pressure to perform, but just to concentrate on enjoyment. That should arouse her feelings. And, you know, you just continue the development of this play with no thought of intercourse, no pressure to perform, to where the feelings should begin to come about. You see, this also probably mean that the husband might, or the wife might have to turn to her husband and say some hard things to him. Do you expect me to go to bed with you when you blah, 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 blah? And, you know, those things need to be said. And they need to be dealt with.
I think another idea that was brought up by Dave was the element of privacy. Doors being locked, that type of thing. And I think that brings up a situation of quality time that the one individual is having with the other. I think as a result of that privacy, that brings into mind a situation where their minds aren't someplace else. That happens frequently. Now, that happens as a result of selfishness. And if the one individual is concerned about meeting the other person's needs, then his mind ought to be on that and not down at the office someplace. Or, you know, her mind being somewhere 20 years in the past or 20 years in the future or on some problem that is of that particular day. So the element of quality time attunably in directing one's attention to meeting the other individual's needs is implied within the privacy sector. The privacy thing serves as a physical measure to preserve that or make that more, even more possible.
Amen. Thank you, Dr. Lang. Now, I'm going to write on what he had to say. I'm going to make a point. priority is determined by prior attention. Write that down. Priority is determined by prior attention. The real measure of your priority is what is on your mind now. Not where you are and that you're talking. You may be talking to somebody, but your mind be a million miles away. And whatever it is your mind is on is what you're giving your priority to. That's why, men, you can come home from work, answer all the questions that are being asked of you by your wife and your children, and never satisfy them emotionally at all. You're not there. You are emotionally a million miles, well, no, 14 miles away downtown in your office. That is your priority, your office, because that's where your prior attention is, even though you may spend 2 hours with your family. I'd say that's 2 hours with very little effect or benefit. Now, if you'll practice that little technique that Ken talked about yesterday morning, of leaving the office, depositing your thoughts and cares and concerns of the office in a trash can, a vacant lot, or someplace along the way home, and start thinking, wife, children, so that as soon as you walk in the door, you're all there. How'd the meeting go today? How was the exam in school? Did you solve this difficulty? Your whole attention is there. You know, a little pat on the behind. You know, the whole business. And then when you're in bed, your whole attention is focused on the other. That's tremendous. That is in contrast with the attitude, well, I'm tired, we got 10 minutes, let's have at it and get this thing over with.
I've got another comment that relates to venereal disease as being prevalent today.
Oh, by the way, he is a doctor.
That disease is called herpes progenitalis. Which is herpes virus infection below the belt, usually in the area of the genitals. Many people experience herpes in other areas of the body. Herpes type 1, which is usually around the lips, at the junction between the lips and the skin per se.
Isn't that like cold sores?
Cold sores, right. Anyway, when one brings up the discussion of oral genital sex, you know, within the substance of what Dr. Wheat was talking about, I think it's super desirable that individuals remember not to ever have that kind of contact, oral genital contact, when one or the other individuals has a cold sore. Okay, because the disorder can be transmitted to the mate, you know, in another part of the body. And when that kind of disorder begins, it recurs again and again and again and again. And there is no good treatment for that particular venereal problem right now. There are about 20 different forms of therapy that are being utilized, none of which is exceptionally good. And that's why a person has cold sores on his lips again and again and again and again. When they occur down in the genital area, it's worse. Males can have tremendous problems. Females can also have tremendous problems.
Okay. Good. Yes.
I wanted to talk about, when you talk about quality time and the emotions being important, in other training lines, this is so true, but when people's lives are so terribly overly filled with not only work, but activities and so forth and so on, to the point that you really can't escape sometimes, certain people are envious and you can't escape them. It's really very hard because you are so physically tired that you don't even care when you wake up and you die. Or the other thing is that you haven't had any time to even talk about, you know, 5 minutes worth of handling of problems during the day, let
Okay, that's a good question, isn't it? Is that many of your experience? It's my experience. Being in the business that I'm in, the ministry, there is no end of people. And who is in control of the world order of things? Satan. And who do you think is in control of the speed of our society? I don't think it's God. And who's paying the price for trying to keep up with it? God's people. And so, yeah, we really do pay a price for the lifestyle that we live. Again, I would have to call your attention to priority. You give yourself to what you feel is important. Now,